AI is making waves in every field it touches. President Biden is now on TikTok, and the election draws closer each day. With so much going on in the world, it is hard to keep up with it all, let me tell you. Hi, I'm Kai Ryssdal, the co-host of Make Me Smart. It's a podcast from Marketplace. And every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I break down the latest in business and the economy with short daily episodes to make it easy for you to stay in the know. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello and welcome to Little Gold Men, the award season podcast from Vanity Fair.
It's such an honor to present this next award.
And here are the nominees.
And the Oscar goes to...
And the Oscar goes to...
And I can't deny the fact that you like me right now. You like me.
I'm the king of the world.
There's a mistake. Moonlight, you guys won Best Picture.
I am Katie Rich, the deputy editor of VanityFair.com, and I'm here with our remote pre-Thanksgiving, everyone is off in a different corners, pseudo-studio. We have our chief critic, Richard Lawson.
Hello.
And our senior writer, Joanna Robinson.
Hi, Katie.
Mike is off baking a turkey, probably, or at least that's what I'll be doing before too long. But we've gathered because this is like the slowest work week and the biggest time for movie releases. Not just movies that are out in theaters, but also a bunch of them that are kind of starting to show for critics and reviews are coming out. And everything is really rushing ahead of the Critics Awards that are going to come really fast as soon as Thanksgiving is over. And then there's also movies in theaters. And we're going to have an interview that Joanna did with Rian Johnson, the director of Knives Out, which is, I think, probably your best bet for like a big take your family to this Thanksgiving release, which we can talk more about. I would say so, right?
Yeah.
Who needs Frozen 2 when you've got a murder mystery?
Great pick.
Yeah. Well, and Joanna, we can talk about it more, but you talked to Rian at Fantastic Fest, which seems like the ideal circumstances for any interview, really.
Absolutely. A lot of queso and tequila floating around the system.
You can smell it in the audio.
Yeah.
But first, so Richard, as we record this, you have a really busy day of reviews. Both Little Women and 1917 reviews are going to go up, which I can't think of a less apt pair. they're both set during wartime, but I can't really think of anything else they have to do with each other.
Both of them star a lot of English people.
That's true, and like beautiful young men in Timothée Chalamet and George MacKay.
Right. Exactly.
Sure. Yeah. Well, let's talk about Little Women first, because Joanna has seen that as well. I still have not, tragically. Richard, I feel like you, and we talked about this in the podcast, you were famously not in love with Lady Bird, whereas the rest of us were, and we shamed you for it. And you might be in for another round of that on Little Women, because you liked it but didn't love it.
Yeah, I mean, I did like Lady Bird. I just didn't view it as maybe favorably as other people. But yeah, Little Women has so much to recommend it. It looks beautiful. There's a great Alexander Desplat score. Saoirse Ronan's amazing. Florence Pugh's amazing. And yet, amid all that, like, I just found the movie to have some pacing problems. You know, Gerwig chooses in her adaptation this kind of bifurcated, dual timeline, sort of future and past, that works cinematically to some extent, but it also kind of reveals things in the future before they've happened in the past, and so it kind of undercuts dramatic stakes. And then also, it just moves really quickly, and I feel like it was partly because, you know, a lot of people, when they adapt things that they love, like Gerwig loves Little Women, the Louisa May Alcott book, she wants to put everything in there, and for a two-hour movie, it just feels a bit overstuffed, and she can't really dedicate enough time to specific moments. Those were kind of my bigger problems with the movie.
And you have read the book Little Women, but it's been a while. Like, you're somewhat familiar with it, but not an expert.
Yeah, I mean, you can't really grow up in Massachusetts with sort of bookish parents. My sister had a birthday party at Louisa May Alcott's house once, so.
Oh my God, I want her review of this movie, too.
You know, it's been a long time since I've read the book, and actually it's been enough ago that I think my dad read it to us.
Wow.
So yeah, forgive me if I'm not totally up, although I did listen to the episode with Radhika that you guys did. And I think that in some ways that I was both familiar with the text in terms of I have read it at some point and I've seen two of the movie adaptations prior to this. You know, that helped, but also that I was a little bit less familiar than, you know, really, really intense fans also helped. And I think what I saw is that I worry a bit that the people who aren't, you know, really kind of clued into the story are going to be a little bit lost. I've spoken to at least one journalist who, you know, he's from England and he didn't grow up reading that book. And he was a bit confused as to what was really happening, I guess. So I'll be curious to see what the reaction is as people get to see it, which, you know, won't be for a month.
Yeah. Joanna, as a Little Women diehard, where'd you?
Yeah. Hold on to your hats and glasses. I agree with Richard completely.
Oh, no!
And tell me what you think about this, Richard. I feel like if this movie were just edited differently, it would have worked. I felt stressed out the whole movie, and it's something to do with the pacing. I don't feel like it's a spoiler to talk about the conceit of how this movie is constructed.
No.
Which is that a lot of the childhood anecdotes that we are very familiar with that usually find their way into the films are told in flashback. And so we pick up sort of with Joe already in New York and Amy already in Europe. And then we flash back to the things that we know. And the flashing back and forth as someone who's been watching a lot of the TV show Lost, I know how a flashback should go in and out. And it's just not always clear. So, for example, once again, Friends already spoiled this plot point, but Beth dies in Little Women. So Greta Gerwig, I think, like, kind of smartly juxtaposes the two Beth illnesses. You get Beth ill, you know, the first time when she, like, makes it through, and then Beth ill when she doesn't make it. But it's edited very confusedly, and the guy behind me is like, wait, I thought she made it. You know what I mean? Like, he was so confused, and he wasn't, like, not paying attention. It's just confusing, I think. You know, for those of us who have read the book, it's not that confusing, but even so, I felt myself just like anxious the whole time. And I don't know if that's what she was going for, but that's the feeling I got from watching Little Women, was a lot of anxiety. There's a lot that I really loved. Florence Pugh, I think, we talked about this, about how the film really is trying to do something with Amy that none of the other films or adaptations have done before, and I think it very much succeeds with that character in isolation. And she's the most convincing, I think, between childhood and adulthood, the difference. Like, you're never in question about which version of Amy you're watching. Hers is the most convincingly different performance. And it solves a lot of the, like, narrative problems. If you already have... not narrative problems, Little Women, but the narrative frustrations people have with Little Women. If you already have Joe, if you start with Joe and Professor Bear, and you start with Amy and Teddy, and then you flash back to this other stuff, you're maybe not as attached to, you know, another coupling as you might be. And so I think that's incredibly smart. A lot of these choices are incredibly smart, but the end result, felt more like jumbled and frenetic than I would have liked it to be. It's a beautiful, it looks beautiful. The Tracy Letts stuff is great. And I will not spoil the ending, because it is very interesting and clever and actually quite emotional. She does something really interesting with the ending, and I won't talk about that. But that, I think, is a triumph, what she does at the very end of the film. It's just some of this, you know, editing stuff is just like, it didn't land for me. So.
Interesting. I should note that you guys, I mean, the reviews are just starting to come out, but I do feel like we've been hearing weeks and weeks of people raving about it. So it's not like, I don't think you guys are way off base as you're talking about other people being confused, but there does seem to be a slightly warmer consensus building around it than what you guys are saying here.
I mean, I will agree with Richard. I liked, but didn't like, I liked a lot, but didn't love. And maybe I just went in with too high expectations, because I did love Lady Bird and I do love Little Women. And, you know, I do love this cast and all that sort of stuff. So maybe I got a little too overexcited about it.
I think that, like, we've spoken about that a lot on this show, and it's something that I think about more and more the more years I do this job. Congrats on almost 6 years, Katie.
Wow, and you too, and almost you, Joanna.
Yeah. Is really how you, when you see something and how it changes things. I mean, I saw this movie, I was in Los Angeles, doing something for work, and I happened to get invited to a screening that was at the Directors Guild Theater, but it was a SAG screening, and the whole cast was there, and everyone in the room was so excited, and I had been, you know, anticipating this movie since it was announced. And I think that, you know, this movie, which is lovely mostly, maybe couldn't hold up to that anticipation. So I just, you know, I'm curious what people will think when they go, you know, with their families over the holidays or on their own or what, you know, whatever configuration, when the sort of stakes feel a little bit lower, they might, I think that maybe you could be more forgiving of what Joanna and I are seeing as some missteps. And, you know, I think another thing about it is that over the years I've gradually become a somewhat reluctant convert to the idea that, like, maybe novels should be miniseries and short stories should be movies.
Yeah, correct.
Because there are so many fine touches that Gerwig gets out of this film, and you know, these lovely moments that you wish that she could just kind of linger on more, but due to the constraints of not wanting to have a four-hour movie, not even a three-hour movie, she can't really linger the way that it feels almost like she wants to. So, you know, I'm imagining the, you know, four-night glossy HBO version of this.
Yes.
And I think it's a knockout. Same director, same cast, everything. I think it's really great.
I agree. And then we'll have, like, the Beth Dies episode and the, you know, Joe and Laurie episode. Anyway, I completely agree. I one last thing I will say, and I think I'm really excited to you see what you think of it, Katie. But you know how the end of Lady Bird is about, it's about like a young woman going to New York. And I think like my memory of you, Katie, is that as someone who went to New York as a young woman to like study, like this is something you really responded to.
And I like
to.
Lost my mind. Yeah, basically.
Yeah. I think you're going to love the beginning of this movie. Like Joe as a young woman in New York and like really experiencing the freedom and the artistic excitement of that is one of the most successful things that's captured. It's like, you know, that it reminded me a lot of the Below Deck dance in Titanic, you know what I mean, where you're just sort of like, it feels like alive and modern but also period appropriate. That's
you want to go to a real party beginning. is that what Professor Mayer says?
Yeah, basically. So I hope you enjoy that, Katie, and I hope you love it, and I hope everyone loves it. Like I always want to like love things with my whole heart, so
yeah. Well, I mean, we'll have more time to talk about Little Women. Obviously I want to talk about it once I get to see it, but to be kind of venal and awardsy about it, like as 1917 emerges out there, we'll talk about that in a minute. It's a really male Best Picture lineup right now with like Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, The Irishman, and now maybe 1917. Does Little Women benefit from being kind of an alternative to that, or is it going to be like most years where they're like, oh well, the women's pictures, they can win acting prizes but not for Best Picture?
I mean, I think it has the patina of a Best Picture nominee, absolutely. Maybe a Best Picture nominee from a different era, you know, in that, you know, you think about like the, when things like The Age of Innocence and all that were being nominated every year, you know, there was always a costume drama. But it does also have a contemporary sensibility. It has contemporary sort of tone, and the performances, while, you know, believable as people in the 19th century, still feel very fresh and it's not a stuffy movie at all. So I think a lot of people glom onto that. I think there's also the narrative that it's a studio movie, that, you know, this is quote unquote not the kind of movie that studios put out anymore. It's from a child of the industry who is I don't think given up acting, but has certainly made the successful leap into a sought after director, which is a narrative, you know, that people really respond to in Hollywood. So yeah, I don't think there's any reason, you know, Joanna and my quibbles included, like that this movie should not be, you know, at least in a short list of five movies. Yeah.
There's also the crazy thing that you talk about studio movies. The other major studio movie in contention is Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, which is also a Sony release. They're kind of the only ones, I guess. Joker and Warner Brothers is another
1917.
Sure, yeah. Yeah, I mean, so I guess the studios are really making a rush at the very end. But Sony has a very interesting dilemma on its hand of two big movies to figure out how to position in there.
Yeah, especially when one of those movies came out practically 6 months ago, you know?
Yeah, definitely.
And I don't think that they're going to have any trouble making Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, like, putting it back in people's minds, you know, in terms of voters. And they're doing more screenings. They did some this weekend. You know, they have that all worked out. But yeah, I think that my worry, I guess, for Little Women would be the thinking, like, if they have to divide, you know, they have to kind of divvy up their resources, they're going to be like, well, you know, it's still in theaters. People know it's out there. Like, we don't need to focus quite as much on Little Women as we do on this older thing. So I don't know. I'll be curious to see how that all plays out.
Yeah.
It's funny to think of the ebb and flow of conversations around these awards films, because I was just looking at my screener pile, screener brag, and I was like, oh, we haven't talked about Judy in a while. Like, we anointed Renee. Renee's going to win is what we've all decided. But then, like, we just stopped talking about Judy, like, entirely.
Who? Yeah.
And
Well, that was the thing that Mark Harris wrote last week, is that like we kind of like reserved a spot for Renee Zellweger, and then Saoirse Ronan and Charlize Theron have kind of been given spots as well. But then you've got people like Alfre Woodard and Cynthia Erivo, who's in Harriet, which has been kind of a surprisingly big hit. Like these narratives kind of solidify. But then I feel like it really just takes one person to be like, but wait a second, it doesn't have to be that way to maybe shake things up. And the Critics Awards, when they start coming in after Thanksgiving, will be a really interesting test case, because I think we talked about this. I don't necessarily expect Renee Zellweger to run the table on that, but I don't know who will instead.
Yeah, it's an interesting. I mean, I don't see Judy being a big, yeah, like you, Katie, a big critics circle kind of winner, but like, I don't know. I think that sometimes people, I guess every voter is different, but I think that in kind of aggregate, it seems, just looking at trends over the years, that like the Academy likes to have at least one sorted, you know? Okay, we don't need to worry about that. You know?
Yeah, well, that's how I felt about Brad Pitt this whole time. Like, just like, let him be the winner. Like, let's give Brad Pitt an Oscar finally and be done with it. But I don't know that anyone else is going to go with that.
And then you let these other interesting, you know, surges happen elsewhere. Like, you know, Gold Derby was just, they sent out some email blast last week being like, you know, in our rankings, J-Lo has just skipped to like number two and just shy of Laura Dern as the favorite to win. Mm-hmm. You know, I think that was based on her getting a Spirit Award nomination and various other things. So, you know, I think that like there can be plenty of excitement within the Academy Awards at large. But like, yeah, if people can just be like, all right, Renee's got it. There are all these great performances that we don't really want to have to sift through, so we'll just do Renee. You know,
listen, just wait till J-Lo hosts a Super Bowl or plays the Super Bowl 3 days before voting closes. Laura Dern's not doing that.
J-Lo in a big like a statuette costume.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at The New Yorker. So join us every week on The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.
Apple Card is the perfect cashback rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase, every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/cardcalculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch. Subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
Okay, let's talk about 1917, which actually might not be a factor in the acting races. You can tell us about that, Richard. But it screened over the weekend. The tweets have been pretty effusive. Your review, Richard, is also pretty effusive. And I didn't necessarily think this would be something that would be for you. Maybe you didn't either.
Well, I mean, I secretly sort of love war movies if they're done well. And this is done very well. You know, it's from Sam Mendes, who... You know, it's funny to think about Sam Mendes' career because, you know, he started in theater. He still goes back to theater once in a while. And then he broke big in the American consciousness with his first film, American Beauty, a movie that at the time was a huge deal, won a slew of Oscars, you know, a new sort of cool, exciting, arty but mainstream director was anointed. And then that movie's reputation has utterly soured in the 20 years since it won.
And it's hard to think of a movie that's only 20 years old that's aged worse.
Yeah, it's real. It's fascinating to look back at that. And there are plenty of pieces out there about what happened with that movie. But and it's not just because of Kevin Spacey. But then in the intervening years, Mendes, like he did some interesting, you know, I was looking at his IMDb. He's only made 10 movies, which I guess is a lot for 20 years, but it feels like he's been around, you know, has done a lot more. But recently he's been so preoccupied with his two Bond movies, Skyfall and Spectre. And so it's interesting to see him kind of doing a new thing, like it was seeing Nolan do something post-Batman. And, you know, that like Nolan's film Dunkirk, this is a very, you know, meticulously crafted kind of the clock, you know, ticking kind of war thing. This is World War I versus Dunkirk's World War II. But there's a lot of pathos and sort of human sentiment in the movie. It's not sentimental, but I think whereas Dunkirk was kind of a chilly sort of formal exercise, this has a bit more heart. But I did, in writing the review, kind of start thinking about my love of war movies and really what that means. And something I kind of get at toward the end of my review of the movie is of 1917 is like, what is the beautiful war movie really doing? You know, I mean, because many would argue that it's just propping up a sort of military industrial devotion to the idea of war, the nobility of war, you know, and it's in honoring the people who died in the conflict, like, you know, many of Sam Mendes' grandfather's, you know, fellow troops. You can do that, but also at the same time, are you sort of propping up a narrative that is kind of politically useful to bad means? So I feel a little bit conflicted about 1917, maybe ethically in a way, but as a piece of filmmaking, it's kind of unimpeachable, I think.
Do you feel conflicted about it in a different way than Dunkirk? I mean, there's been a million war movies, so it's almost unfair to compare it to Dunkirk, but I did think like that was similarly like beautiful, about sacrifice. Like it does have kind of this rousing patriotic ending, but it didn't make me feel like it was valorizing war in the same way, or maybe I just didn't think about it in that way.
Well, I think the crucial difference between the two things is that Dunkirk, for me, the rousing kind of moment is that it's civilians, you know, getting in their little ships and heading across the English Channel to just rescue their people, their sons,
to war,
their brothers,
George.
You know, exactly. whereas, you know, 1917 is just strictly about soldiers. And while the soldiers in the film, played by George MacKay and Dean Charles Chapman from Game of Thrones, are heroic, but in a very human way, you certainly don't want anything to befall them. I think that in these beautiful images of terrifying things, of combat, of people running from bombs and bullets and across, you know, fields strewn with bodies, like, I just wonder, like, how beautiful anything like that should be.
That's a really good point. I have a follow-up question to that. Like, the big talking point around 1917 is this, like, this sort of one-shot aspect. Do you think the film needs that? Do you think that, like, what do you make of that conversation? Because, like, what I've been seeing mostly is people being like, and maybe it's just one person, but people being like, oh, I can see where all the edits were, you know? And I was just sort of like, then it becomes this, like, weird game, and I don't know that, like, I guess I don't know that I feel like, or I guess I'm concerned it's overshadowing the fact that this is just like maybe a great movie, and maybe it could just be a great movie without that hook, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a tricky thing with anything. I mean, you know, that does a kind of technically audacious thing like that. You know, I think back to Joe Wright, a very similar British director, his movie Atonement, the adaptation of the Ian McEwan novel, a novel I love, a movie I don't love. And there's this incredible 7-minute tracking shot across the beaches of Dunkirk, funnily enough. That's an incredible feat of filmmaking, but like, I think it's distracting because you're just kind of noticing the technical details and not feeling as much of the emotional punch as maybe you should. I don't find that that's a problem with 1917. Did I find myself playing the game of like, oh, is that, that's probably where they made a cut or whatever? Yeah, sure. But like, for the most part, I was pretty enveloped. And I think that the crucial thing about why they did this quote-unquote real-time thing, it's kind of like Birdman, which all looks like one take but actually isn't. I mean, 1917 is broken up into two distinct parts. But anyway, is that what it really communicates terrifyingly is for these young men was that like a kind of, I mean, as normal a day as you could have during a huge war, you know, a quiet morning can be, you know, just 90 minutes later be a real fight for your own, for survival, you know? And I think that having you just kind of dialed into the really short timeline of this movie, you know, gets that across pretty powerfully.
So Richard, you were, we both saw at Toronto, The True History of the Kelly Gang with George MacKay, which is coming out in the spring. But this looks like it's going to be his like breakout movie. Is he a standout? Are there acting standouts, or is this really like a giant technical accomplishment? And then Oscar Isaac is going to kind of go off of that.
I mean, both MacKay and Chapman are really good. You know, MacKay is kind of the more stoic, you know, he's a little bit older than the other character. He's been through at least one hellish battle and sort of has the trauma to deal with that, you know, and he's very muted. But there are enough moments, I think, when MacKay is able to, you know, express something pretty deep, he does that really well. I think he's a really exciting actor who's really coming into his own in his late 20s. And yeah, this ought to be a big sort of calling card movie for him. I think a lot of talent people and casting agents who were either aware of him but not quite sure if he could carry a movie, will see this and be like, we got to get this guy.
Yeah. And the supporting cast is like a lot more famous, but mostly kind of one-offs, right? Like Benedict Cumberbatch is not in very much of this.
Yeah, they're one-offs and I don't like them, you know, because, you know, I understand maybe they needed to have Benedict Cumberbatch attached or Colin Firth attached for financing reasons or something. I don't pretend to know the ins and outs of that process, but like, you know, you're so locked in on this thing and then there's one shot and a guy with a helmet turns his head and, oh, it's Benedict Cumberbatch. And you just get that much, you know, pulled out of the movie.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, because the one shot is already distracting. And then you get the stars like popping in there too.
Yeah, and there's one that I don't want to spoil at the end where you're like, oh, come on.
It's the queen. It just shows up at the end.
It was somebody I was very glad to see. There's a hint, but I also didn't want to see him in that movie in that particular part.
Yeah. All right. So Richard, is it the best picture frontrunner right now? Like when I looked up the tweets, I saw like multiple people doing that, which I don't know. That happens like 5 times a year. But is it actually as strong a contender as some of the most hyped people want you to think?
I mean, it's going to get nominated, I think.
Yeah. We've been kind of reserving a spot for it. Like, it's been on the short list.
It's harder with 5 director slots versus, you know, the potential 10 for Best Picture. But, like, Mendes does so much in this movie, you know, with the help of editors and Roger Deakins, the cinematographer. But, like, I don't know. I find it really hard to believe that people are going to watch that over the holidays and be like, you know, he doesn't need it or whatever. Like, I think that it has that. It's got a lot of technical, obviously, things going for it. But, you know, kind of like Dunkirk, which got a lot of nominations, but didn't win the prize for Nolan as people once thought it would. I don't know that war films are for everybody. And I think that they can be a really hard sit. And I think that just the kind of premise of it, the idea of it is a put off to a lot of people. So I think it has that to kind of combat. And I also think, and maybe this is cynical, but the fact that it's not about Americans and it's not about World War II, which is a war that, you know, everyone on at least the right side of things can look to as a quote righteous war. World War I was a lot more complicated, a lot more, I mean, pointless in a way. And so I don't really know if people are going to have the emotional lock into this movie the way they might Saving Private Ryan.
Yeah.
Which didn't win Best Picture.
It's true. Yeah, the last war movie. Oh, God, can anyone do this off the top of their head? The last war movie to win Best Picture? Platoon? Is it that far back? Anyway, someone can write
it
and tell us.
Does Forrest Gump count?
Maybe. Well, anyway, I guess 1917 is another thing that will kind of thrive on box office, which will be interesting because it's opening at Christmas, opposite Little Women and some of the movies of the year, Cats. But I want to talk about box office real quick before we start looking forward, including to Cats, because both Ford versus Ferrari and A Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood opened this weekend against Frozen 2, but obvious counter-programming. And they both did really well. Like, I feel like they got a very effective counter-programming for, you know, us and people older than us who don't want to see Frozen 2. Is that... I feel like a lot of people have been worried about A Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood maybe sliding under because it's a little bit quieter of a movie. Are we heartened by this?
Yeah, absolutely. I was really very pleasantly surprised and pleased by the performance of both of those movies, and especially after that viral Jeopardy clip of 3 contestants not knowing who Tom Hanks was. I was like, oh no. Like any time those movies do, like Ford versus Ferrari, I am astonished by and kind of excited by that it's doing so well. I don't know why. I just kind of felt like that movie was not, you know, gaining any traction in, but then again, I just really need to pay better attention. A couple of my friends have been like, have you seen it? Can we see it? Have you seen it? Can we see it? And I thought they were just like weird anomaly car freaks, but apparently, Ford versus Ferrari is something that people are really excited about. Who knew?
My parents went to see it. My parents never go to the movies. They're like, yeah, we loved it. I was like, wow, you didn't even tell me that was happening. You didn't ask me for advice. They just went.
So star power? Like, what are we attributing this to?
It's like star power. It looks fun. It's glossy. Like the sunglasses. Don't underestimate the sunglasses. It has this kind of like, you don't know what you're getting because it's not like IP exactly, but it kind of has all the polish of something that feels like something you know you're going to enjoy.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, perhaps the market doesn't exactly suggest this, but I would have to think at some point that, like, there are people all across North America who are, you know, like to go to the movies, but are kind of sick of being force-fed IP and, you know, sequels upon sequels. And, you know, you look at the performance of Terminator, Dark Fate, and Charlie's Angels this fall, that, you know, two franchise extensions, essentially, in different ways, that both completely tanked. And then you have these other sort of more original things, you know, but original, but yet sort of studio blessed, like they have the glow of, of, you know, accessible movies. You know, people are going to seek that out. You know, it's funny, I'm looking at the numbers.com, which is the kind of new film nerd go-to for box office because of Box Office Mojo's terrible redesign.
Which is what I'm looking at right now and losing my mind.
Yeah. And they kind of cited Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood's $13.5 million as a bit of a disappointment compared to, like, the effusive reviews. I don't really see it that way. And I also think that, like, if there was ever a Thanksgiving movie that is not, a big epic kind of thing, like, it's that. I mean, like, you know, we always kind of go to this scenario, but, like, imagine being at Thanksgiving and you have to satisfy the needs of 4, 5, 6, 7 more people about what you're going to go see at the movies. You know, maybe some sullen teen will groan about that and go see whatever they want to see. They'll go see Terminator Dark Fate if it's still playing anywhere. But, like, people will want to see Mr. Rogers, you know, and they'll want to see Tom Hanks do it. And even if people on Jeopardy don't know who he is. So I don't know. I think that, like, it was a good opening salvo for that movie.
Yeah.
And I would imagine it will not, it will only do better this coming weekend. And could be one of those, like, steady movies that barely drops week to week and just has, like, a nice long run.
Well, if you if you think about, like, you know, how many of us went to go see the Mr. Rogers documentary last year and, like, cried our little hearts out in the middle of the summer. Mr. Rogers is kind of its own IP in a way.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it has that advantage, that recognition. And yeah, I completely agree with Richard. This is the Joanna completely agrees with Richard episode, that, like, I could really see this movie having just, like, a long tail, a really long tail.
Yeah, so, I got the screener on Friday, which is the day that it opened in theaters, and I have yet to watch it, but it is, like, the thing. It's basically the one that I'm telling my husband, like, we're watching this right now, like, the minute I can get your attention. So it's high on the top of my list, and I think it will be for anybody else who has a screener too.
Wait, can I embarrass myself and everyone I know by telling you what is at the top of my screener list?
Yeah. Is it Rocket Man?
I've already seen, I can close my eyes and see Rocket Man. It's fine. It's Last Christmas. I was just like, oh, I could just see it and not have to go to the theater, and people liked it. Anyway, there we go.
But then Last Christmas would do better if it was released, like, now versus a few weeks ago, you know?
Oh, if it was too early,
like,
for the Christmas wave?
People weren't quite hungry for it yet. Like, I went to go see, we're recording on a Monday, last night, a Sunday night, I went to go see the Broadway production of Christmas Carol that was kind of imported from London. And, like, right. I left and I was like, okay, it's Christmas, bitch. Like, I'm ready. Like, and I just wonder if Last Christmas had just waited, that maybe they could have captured that sort of swell, but oh well.
Yeah, I was watching the American Music Awards on Sunday night, and there were, like, all of the ads were Christmas themed, you know, that time of year when, like, all the same ads for the same people just have snow in them. And I was like, okay, here we go. I don't know. I'm ready. I think you're right that Last Christmas might have a better audience right now.
Oh, well.
I'm Alex Schwartz.
I'm Nomi Fry.
I'm Vincent Cunningham, and this is Critics at Large, a New Yorker podcast for the culturally curious.
Each week, we're going to talk about a big idea that's showing up across the cultural landscape, and we'll trace it through all the mediums we love. Books, movies, television, music, art.
And I always want to talk about celebrity gossip, too.
Of course.
What are you guys excited to cover in the next few months?
There's a new translation of The Iliad that's coming out, Emily Wilson. Really excited to see whether I can read The Iliad again, whether I'm that literate. I mean, the jury is out.
I can't wait to hear Adam Driver go again in an Italian accent in Michael Mann's Ferrari.
He can't stop.
I mean, and bless him. I can't wait.
Molto bene.
Molto bene.
We hope you'll join us for new episodes each Thursday. Follow Critics at Large today, wherever you get podcasts.
You really don't want to miss this.
Don't.
Don't miss this.
Don't miss it.
See you soon.
Okay, let's, before we get into the movies that are out this weekend and talk a little bit about Knives Out, Richard, I think you wanted to preview the either hell or wonder that's awaiting you in mid-December when kind of the last two question marks of the year finally emerge.
Yeah, so about this time of year, you know, if you're ever kind of getting drinks with colleagues, you start making the list of like, okay, what do I have left to see this year, you know, of the big things. And it had gotten winnowed down to like, I haven't seen Star Wars yet. I haven't seen Cats. And those are the last two. When are they going to come? And so we got a Star Wars invite. Yay, yay, yay. And then still nothing from Cats, nothing from Cats. And finally, I just was like, all right, I can't take it anymore. So I emailed publicist at Universal. I was like, all right, look, when are you guys showing this movie to me? They are screening, in New York at least, I'm sure it's the same in LA and probably elsewhere. They are screening Cats and Star Wars on the same day. And so both movies are doing a morning screening and both are doing a night. The thinking being, if you have to go to one in the morning, you can go to the other at night. which has presented this insane Sophie's Choice of like, which do I see? Which movie do I want to have seen first? You know? And obviously the answer to that is Cats.
Yes.
But because of the way the review embargo situation works, I have to prioritize Star Wars because that embargo's up sooner. So I'll have, like, just to give myself maximum time to write each review. But, like, I was texting with friend of the podcast, David Sims, other friend of the podcast, Esther Duckerman, and I was just like, but, like, I'm going to be agonizing the whole time during Star Wars knowing that, like, however far, how many feet away there are people watching Cats and I'm not. So I don't know why they're doing this to us. They're competing studios, so what do they care? But like, it's good that December 17th, a day that shall live in infamy.
Oh my God, I can't wait to hear like, what if you like Cats better than Star Wars? Like, what if this creates a really insane contrast?
Katie, no. Katie, no.
What if I get confused in writing my review and someone's like, wait, Kylo Ren fights someone named Griddlebone? Like what?
Laser Cats. Just like post that YouTube, like that SNL digital shorts, Laser Cats, and you're like, this is what I saw today.
Well, lucky for you, Star Wars nerds are very forgiving and understanding. So if you mess something up, I'm sure no one will make a big deal about it. Okay, let's talk about Knives Out because we have this interview with Rian Johnson. It's out in theaters this weekend. I saw it in Toronto, and I've been one of many people kind of both raving about it and trying not to say anything about it. And we're not going to spoil it because I think if you know anything about it, you know that it's a really twisty mystery that doesn't deserve to be spoiled. But I don't know. What else do we want to say to get people to go see Knives Out?
You were mentioning that you thought it might be a good, like, please everyone kind of film to take the whole family to, and I think that's true. I think the way it's cast in that regard is so clever because there's like someone for every demographic. Like, hey, are you young and you like 13 Reasons Why? Catherine Langford's here. Hey, you like Marvel movies? Chris Evans is here. Hey, you like Jamie Lee Curtis, Don Johnson, and all, you know. So like, I don't think that's why he cast it, but I'm just saying, like, I think there are a lot of people who are excited for Knives Out because they're like, oh, it's the trailer where Chris Evans swears. That's fun.
I will say Catherine Langford and Jamie Lee Curtis presented together at the American Music Awards last night. So like the cross generational demo is strong.
Perfect. Yeah, so I like the cast is incredible. You know, Daniel Craig doing like, you know, going to 11. It's just a really fine time at the movies. So I really encourage people to see it. What do you think, Richard?
Well, I think that, you know, this isn't a spoiler, I don't think, but like there is one scene that in a very kind of Rian Johnson arch way crystallizes a political debate happening right now in terms of like, so if you're having Thanksgiving and you're sick of one side yelling at the other side about whatever, you will get the catharsis of seeing some version of that on screen in Knives Out. But yeah, I think that it's you know, again, talking about like quote unquote counter programming. This is a movie that is not based on anything. It's new. It has actors, you know, doing things you haven't seen them do before, probably. Certainly in the case of Daniel Craig, and I don't know, there's like appeal there. And I don't know, I think that like, I used to do these things, I don't think I did it for VF, but other places I wrote in years past where I would like do like Thanksgiving or holiday movie recommendations, you know, based on like your sort of situation. Like, I think that this would be a good, like, all the adult cousins go see it, you know, maybe like the hip aunt or whatever. Like, I think it's that kind of thing where like maybe the little ones go to Frozen 2 and you go to this. And I think it really satisfies a certain kind of merry darkness that people find themselves in this time of year. And yeah, I think it's a lot of fun. I've seen it twice now. So, and it has not dimmed in my estimation.
I've also seen it twice. I saw it this because they did like a little preview in, you know, this past weekend. They released it early in some markets. And so I saw it in the Alamo Drafthouse in Denver over the weekend, actually, with a bunch of podcast listeners. And that was really fun. But I liked it even better the second time, because the first time I think I got, you know, because I have read, and you'll hear me talking to Ryan about this. Basically, I just like nerded out about Agatha Christie with Ryan Johnson and musicals. I apologize for nothing. But like... because I'm such like an Agatha Christie weirdo, my brain was like too engaged in the twists and turns of the whodunit and either feeling ahead or behind or whatever it was the first time I saw it. And the second time through, I was just able to enjoy what everyone was doing performance wise, like just like sit back and enjoy all the nutty performances. And it was just like Don Johnson, the twinkle. I'm here for the Don Johnson Assance. So,
yeah. Been a good year for what we said, Dakota's dads, for him and Antonio Banderas.
Yeah. The year of Dakota's dads.
And
so,
If you were looking for, I mean, this could apply to anyone of any gender identity, but like if you're looking for some great winter wear jackets, Lakeith Stanfield wears this beautiful, I don't know, wool sort of number that I'm obsessed with, and I'm sure it costs $4,000, but like
Chris Evans scarves.
Oh God, and sweater. His sweat.
Sweater, the cable knit. Yeah,
it's good. It's good clothing. It's a nice Massachusetts filmed movie, which I appreciate.
Didn't know that was the theme of this episode.
Yeah. Well, I think I'm sad because my parents don't live in Massachusetts anymore, so I'm just trying to cling to my identity as an asshole.
Okay, Joanna. So, anything else you want to tell us about your conversation with Knives Out director and writer Ryan Johnson?
No, just that he's an utter delight. And one thing I will say is if you're deciding what to go see at the box office or at the box office, at the movie theater this weekend, or Ryan has said that if Knives Out does well, maybe this will become a franchise and we will see Daniel Craig solve more crimes. And I'm just saying like that is the best motivator I could possibly. He's also promised us a Chris Evans musical. So like Ryan is just out here.
He's making
trying
a lot of promises.
Trying to give us the content we want, but we need to show up to the movie theater and give this a good box office push. So I really encourage, you know, you're not going to get Ford versus Ferrari 2, but you might get Knives Out 2. So I'm just saying.
I should also note, we talked a couple weeks ago about how Tracy Letts became the first husband-wife pair we'd had on the podcast because we'd had Carrie Coon, and now we've had Ryan and his wife Karina Longworth in 1 month. So we're doing well.
Listen, it's a new Hollywood dynasty.
Bringing in all of our favorite power couples. All right, let's listen to your conversation with Ryan Johnson.
So we are pleased to welcome to the podcast Ryan Johnson. Ryan, thank you so much.
Hey, Joe. Great to be here.
For doing it. You are a huge fan of the whodunit genre. What do you think is the appeal, like the enduring appeal of that kind of story?
I mean, I think there's a couple things about it. I mean, first of all, it's got a great kind of like, you know, when you like eat a dish at a restaurant and it's got like two opposing flavors that go well together.
Sure.
Or when you eat a Reese's peanut butter cup, it's got kind of the cerebral puzzle box element of it, of the mystery. And then it's also something that's built around the joy of characters and of it lends itself to these big fun personalities of these cast of suspects.
Right.
So the combination of those two things, I think, is really fun. There's also, I mean, it's interesting to me, like, you know, the golden age of the genre, arguably, I guess, was back kind of in the 20s and 30s, I guess.
Yeah.
And in the 30s, when it was really taking root, you think about the state of the world back then and how much moral uncertainty there was in the world. And there was, that's something that's very distinct to the whodunit genre, is the moral certitude of it. It has this comforting thing where the world is thrown into chaos by this crime and the detective comes in and you know that the good person detective is going to set the world right by the end of it. Figure it out, restore moral order, and the bad person will go to jail. And you can see why that felt
right
really, really good in the 30s. And I think that's also, that feels really, really good right now.
Yeah.
So I think that's also an element of it. And that's something that distinguishes it also from other kinds of detective fiction, you know, like Hammett and Chandler.
Right.
There's always a moral murkiness. There's no moral murkiness in whodunits. It's always very clear.
Agatha Christie has a lot of clarity.
Agatha Christie, John Dixon Card, Dorothy Sayers, all of the great ones. There's always a clarity to the right and wrong, and there's a cleanness to it, which, you know, is maybe more of a fantasy. But as Billy Joel said, sometimes a fantasy is all you need.
Do you have a favorite Agatha Christie novel?
I mean, I think even though it's kind of non-traditional in terms of whodunit, I think And Then There Were None is her best book.
Yeah.
My kind of two favorites are The Murder of Roger Ackroyd, where she, I don't know if you're, mm-hmm. yeah, it
oh,
was
yeah.
so, I mean, just because of the audaciousness of the solution.
Yeah.
Which is so audacious that even at the time, lots of people called foul on it, and people said this is cheating, and which is fascinating to me. But it's also a great Poirot book. And then I'm a really big fan of Curtin, the final book, which was published posthumously, and which is Poirot's last case.
Yeah,
and it also has this. It was, you know, at the end of her crazy, but it was you know, when the last. Things that it was the last thing that was published. I forget when she wrote it. I think she wrote it like
a little bit earlier. Yeah.
But it's equally audacious and crazy in terms of the gambit that it, you know, that it attempts. And the solution is fascinating, and the way that it ties up Poirot's entire arc and what it kind of makes him do at the end of the book. You can see I'm talking around a lot of things, but it's gorgeous. And it's also the paperback cover of it was just entirely black with Curtin in this great font, which we ripped off for Knives Out. The Knives Out font. That's the Curtin font. And it's had this oil painting of a guy who's supposed to be Poirot. And it was the creepiest book cover in the world.
I love those late Christie ones. They're very creepy. And there's a lot of, you know, like Halloween. When the counterculture sort of gets in there. And
you can tell that, yeah, absolutely. And there's a darkness that creeps into it. Was it Halloween story? The one that was a Halloween party. It's like a girl who's drowned, like bobbing for apples. It's really, really dark.
When like the drug scenes get in there. And then there's a lot of like spiritualism that sort of gets into her later stuff too.
And that speaks to how much she was always engaged with the culture that she was in, and how she was always using these characters and these kind of caricatures she was creating to talk about the world that she was in at the time. And that's another thing with Knives Out is trying to, I think a lot of times, kind of the musty old tropes from old whodunits are seen as that, when in reality she was writing about very present character types.
Right.
So the idea of doing that in 2019 with character types we'll recognize today, that was part of it.
Yeah, and I definitely want to get to that, some of the politics that are in this without, we want to talk about this movie without spoiling it for people.
Yes, please.
So talking around things. But so before I move off Dame Agatha, who I just love, I'm curious, when you want to do something like this, which is playing in the genre and homage to her work and other people who have done whodunits, how do you balance between homage and, you know, not falling into parody or pastiche or anything like
right.
that?
Right. Well, I mean, I think for me, it's the same way that I kind of come at any genre that I'm trying to do that I love, which is the first step is kind of figuring out for me what I essentially love about it.
Right.
Not just examples of it that I love that I want to like copy or do karaoke of, but really what the essential pleasure of the thing is for me. And then I set that as my goal, and I find my own kind of path towards that, and just kind of trust blindly a little bit that if I'm doing that, it's not going to be the same path that somebody else has taken before. You know, it's going to be unique. And also I, you know, for as much as I love, you know, I don't know how you said genre engineering, I guess, genre wonkiness, I've found I can't sit down to write something if I don't also have a, you know, something I on my mind, something I care about, not like a message or something like that, but just something I want to grapple with that's actually in my heart at that moment, that the genre mechanics click together with, like two gears coming together, and that they complement each other. That's like an essential ingredient for me.
And so, you've talked a lot about the challenge of injecting heart into this story, that it's not just like witty line readings and obfuscation, but how do I put the heart in? So what was it to you? Was it the election? Like, what was it to you that really drove you to this?
Well, I mean, it's less fun to talk about than it is to see in the movie. And there's a reason it's one element in this bigger movie as opposed to, you know, an essay that I wrote about something. So in that way, I'll probably talk around this a little bit too, but it's, you know, to a certain extent, it's about, you know, even because I've been cooking this thing up for like 10 years.
Right.
And so the basic foundation of what it's about predates all the craziness that's happening right now. It wasn't, I sat down, I read it. Obviously I'm trying to write it for 2019. So I'm plugging in all the stuff that we're arguing about today. But for me, the essence of it was really about, I mean, for lack of a better word, I guess about privilege, you know, and about how we rewrite our own narratives so easily. And all of us, I'm guilty as anyone of this. Once we kind of get in the castle, we rewrite our own narratives to pull the drawbridge up behind us and try and pretend that that
we were always here.
We were always here.
Yeah.
And we're here because of who we essentially are, not because of circumstances that got us here.
Yeah.
And that doesn't mean not taking pride in your accomplishments. That doesn't mean not celebrating the fact that you're in the castle. It's awesome, you're in the castle. But that also means leaving that drawbridge open and recognizing that people that are still making their way in, that you had a lot of help, you had a lot of circumstances on your side, and not everybody has those. And that to me was more the essence of it as opposed to any very specific political circumstance.
You know? Right. Yeah. You didn't hear something on the news and go, aha, I must write my masterpiece.
This is where I change everybody's mind and fix the world.
Something I love about personally growing up and reading a lot of Agatha Christie, and I would recommend it to anyone who wants to, you know, if you're young and listening and want to become a writer, I think Agatha Christie is a great thing because she is, yes, rinsing and repeating a lot of things, but always doing it in an inventive way that helps you understand how story works.
Absolutely.
You know? Yeah. And so I'm wondering if you learned anything from her about, I don't know, specifically the art of misdirection, obfuscation, and how to land a story that, I don't know, not trying to be smarter or really deeply outwit your audience, but respect your audience's intelligence, but try to keep them in the game.
Yeah, I mean, she does not get enough credit as a writer, I think. I think people kind of, you know, she gets kind of, I get dismissed as too strong a word, but people tend to view her books as crossword puzzles. And the truth is she is a fantastic writer. Her books are also hilarious. They have the characters that she's drawing, they are elevated characters. They are slightly caricatures. It's not like deep character studies of anybody, but they also are always grounded and always have an element to them where you can identify with them.
Right.
And like I said, they're always plugged into the world, the society that she's living in. In terms of specific lessons, I guess for me, that's the big one that I take when I revisit Christie, is how much the books, for all their plotting and all the puzzle book elements of them, how much they live or die based on how much you want to be engaged with the characters in them. And that her books also always have a character who is kind of what the character of Marta is in this, where there's always a character who is like the heart of it, who you are, and usually it's the character that Poirot has like a little heart to heart with at some point in the book. And sometimes that person is the killer, you know, in Death on the Nile, I don't want to give away.
It's Mia Farrow.
It's Mia Farrow. Yeah. Very, very often, you know, and you get this tragic sense of foreshadowing. The Poirot senses this and is trying to stave it off. And so, and even that is like, that turns it from something where it's just the bad guy getting caught into something where it's always much more powerful if you can relate to the motives that, and that's the other interesting thing that she always does, or she does very often, I should say, is the person who gets killed, at least the first person who gets killed, the main person that sets it all off, is never a sympathetic character. And who you identify with in the first part of the book is not the poor person who gets killed.
Right.
You actually identify with all the people who had motives to kill this person because the motives need to make sense. And so, and that's fascinating. And then there's always the secondary person who gets killed who is the real tragic one.
Right.
And that's usually the murder that happens on screen, on the page. Like you're usually, that's the one where it's like you're with the person, they're doing laundry, and then she does that trick where it's like, she turns around and says, "Oh, I didn't expect to see you here. Wait, what?" And then she's strangled, you know, or something. And it's usually, that's the one where you're it's like the horror movie kill where you don't want them to get killed and die.
Or you're like, "Oh, this is serious.
Yeah,
this is real. It's not who died before the book started, so it's sort of detached. It's like,
and it also primes you for wanting that person to get caught at the end.
Now it's cruel.
Exactly. Sort of
That's the moment when I was watching Knives Out. That's the moment where I really realized that you had read as much Agatha Christie as you had, when I realized that the character of Marta was one of these sort of intrepid young female characters that Agatha Christie does so well. And I almost feel like she Trojan horsed them into a lot, like that she wanted to have a young female detective, but that is not what she did. She had Hercule Poirot, she had Marple, but she sort of snuck all these young women into her
stories.
There's
always one element of it that's like the, and Curtin has one as well. It's interesting. Yeah. And, yeah, absolutely.
You mentioned the sort of the desire to put The Way We Live Now into this story the way that Agatha Christie would. There's this scene, I will not spoil it, that I've heard a lot of people refer to as the Twitter argument, you know, the Twitter argument scene. And I know that you've talked about that sort of specifically as, once again, trying, that's the way a lot of us communicate now. So it's very real and now. But are you, given how fraught Twitter can be for any creative, especially one who's touched a major property, is there any sort of exercising that happens when you get to put that on screen and say, this is what this looks like?
Well, I mean, it's funny because that specific scene, it's my experience and where that's coming from is actually not Twitter.
Oh,
it's,
really?
No, it's I have people that I'm very close to and that I love dearly in my life, and we feel very differently about a lot of things that are happening in the news. So that is that's actually much more based on real life interactions I've had with different folks.
Okay.
And so to me, I mean, I guess that extends to Twitter. We're all arguing about the same stuff, and you can make an argument that the degree to which real life is now being influenced by the way everything is being framed online in these black and white sort of choose your side type ways, that's a very real thing, I guess. But and it's something that's so pervasive, and it's so it touches. If you're it's tough because it's easy to say if you're online today you've experienced this in some way, shape, or form. It does, if I feel like if, and you don't have to have be in the middle of the politics fray, and you don't have to have made a Star Wars movie to have experienced it. I feel like in 2019, if you're a baker and you make a tweet about bread that's controversial, you're going to have people screaming at you in your contents that why don't you die?
Right. Or if you assert a certain kind of Halloween candy is the best, and then all of a sudden whatever it becomes.
It's just the waters that we're all swimming in right now. And I think that does bleed into our everyday life, to where even if you get off of social media, you find the discourse in just regular conversation, you know, at least starts that way and then gets more human, hopefully, the longer you engage with someone. Anyway, but it's all to say that, you know, it wasn't so much like, I don't know, like trying to get back at it. But it was very much like, God, this is what happens when everyone has a few drinks and starts talking about this stuff.
Yeah,
well, it devolves into everyone just telling each other to eat shit. You know?
Yeah, and it goes back to that sort of lack of moral clarity that you were talking about in terms of like, what I feel like right now is we're so bifurcated and like everyone's on their sides and are certain that their side is the morally correct side. And then sort of how do you find the center of that? You know?
Yeah. And it's tough because you don't, you know, I don't think very much with the movie didn't want to like both sides any issue or something. The movie definitely has a point of view, but it also, I think it also, I hope like, you know, also indicates that sort of the arguments that are being had and the positions that are being taken don't really speak to the true problem at the heart of all of this, you know, and it's a problem that I think applies to humans, you know, not to one side or the other side. And so trying to get at that, I think, is the more interesting thing.
When I talked to Brad Bird about Incredibles 2 on this podcast, I just went rogue and talked to him about musicals the whole time. So I know that
let's go rogue.
Well, I know you've been talking about musicals in these various interviews. I know you, Chris Evans has agreed to do a musical with you. And I believe in Canada, that's a legally binding contract.
Yeah. We didn't even have to sign an napkin.
Yeah, that's just Canadian law.
It would be impolite to not make it now.
Right.
And that's illegal in Canada.
So what, you know, I know you've been noodling maybe doing a movie musical for a long time. And we're currently in a little bit of a resurgence of movie musicals. What's going on right now in movie musicals that you are really digging? And what, you know, you're so good at saying like, okay, but I miss this that we used to do. What kind of thing do you want to bring back?
I mean, so it's funny. I somehow have not seen Greatest Showman. I really need to see it. I have a feeling I'm going to love it. But I haven't seen it. And what are some other very recent examples?
I feel like La La Land.
Oh,
sort
I really, yeah, I enjoyed La La Land a lot. Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. I mean, for me, most of my touchstones in terms of movie musicals I love are from back in the day.
Right.
Talking about Frank Oz, I think that, you know, who does a cameo in this movie, was very gracious to come and do a cameo in Knives Out.
He's great.
He's so lovely, man. But he made Little Shop of Horrors, I think, is one of the all-time greats. Maybe my favorite movie musical is actually, this is a bit controversial, but Jesus Christ Superstar might stealth be one of the
really?
Maybe, yeah, because I mean it's so of its time, but it also it looks the way it sounds and it feels the way it sounds.
It
and
does.
The energy to it is so plugged in and electrified.
Yeah.
And it's got such conviction and it's funky and crazy and it goes for it. It's completely immersed in what it's doing.
Yeah.
And the movie, it kind of doesn't give a fuck. It just does it. And it's amazing. So a lot of my musical references kind of go back to that. And I don't know, I'd have to dig into it and really figure out, like, do that kind of part of the process where
deep genre
out,
research
or not even research, kind of researching myself, kind of figuring out, okay, what do I really love about this and what would I want to, you know, what would I really want to pull out of it. Yeah,
I know that you and your producing partner Ram have been talking a lot about, like, okay, potentially Knives Out could be the beginning of a franchise, but if it were, the film would have to perform really well sort of at the box office from the jump. Go see Knives Out opening weekend, everybody. but, you know, this is the kind of original concept, mid-level movie that so many of us are bemoaning the lack of, the death of.
Yeah.
As someone who makes these kinds of movies more often than not, what are the pressures of wanting to put something like that out in 2019?
Oh, I don't know. I mean, I think that I tend to kind of, I don't know, I can see the point. I can see what everyone's talking about, but I don't tend to engage in much hand-wringing about this stuff. I feel like, I don't know, I feel like I get to the end of every year, I look at my top 10 list, and I feel like I could put 20 movies on there. I feel like there's a lot of stuff that, and I love big movies, obviously. I love big franchise stuff, most of the movies that I love every year are the more mid-size and small stuff, and I see tons of interesting stuff getting made every single year. And I mean, the tough thing is getting people out to see them, I guess.
Right.
But I don't know. The answer is not to scold people for not going to see the right movies. It's like, the answer is to, you know, make stuff that hopefully people will like and then try and show them what's good about it to motivate them to get out to see it. You know, I definitely don't feel like, oh God, this type of movie is dying. I don't feel like I'm hovering over the body trying to do CPR on something. I feel like interesting movies are alive and well, and there's tons of great ones being made every year. And I think people should go see them, not because they need to save cinema, but because they're so many great movies out there, and there's so much, and you're going to have an experience that you never expected, and you're going to see it with a crowd. And that's one of the things with this movie, is it was kind of manufactured to be seen with a crowd.
Yeah.
It's something where it's a ride and it's hopefully funny, and you're going to get a reaction with the audience around you. And Yeah. Yeah. So, yeah.
Not to make you engage in one more hand-wringing question, but I think the reason that a lot of people are going to some place like Netflix is because they want to make this kind of movie and feel like a lot of people are going to see it. Do you feel sort of the siren song of Netflix at any point? Or are you like firmly in the theatrical camp? Or
I don't know. I mean, look, I love movies in theaters. I love going to see them in theaters as a movie fan. I love making them so that people can go see them in theaters. So I will, you know, I will beat that drum as long as I possibly can. But, you know, at the end of the day also, I don't know. And this has been something that since the birth of cinema, since the birth of cinema,
sure,
it's been evolving in terms of how we take it in, what it is, who it appeals to. It's something that has constantly been falling apart and being rebuilt. And I think that for me, I feel like as opposed to latching on to this medium seen in this way is what I do and that's the only pure expression of it, I think we're all, I don't know, that's the most pretentious word in the world, but we're all storytellers. We are all storytellers. I'm not making something that's on this format to be seen this way in this kind of environment. I'm telling stories. I'll keep telling them however people, you know, however I can get most eyes on them for people to go see them. You know,
yeah,
that's what's important to me, is for somebody to sit down and have an experience watching the thing that I made, you know, not dictating that they do it in a certain way. So,
right.
But, you know, that having been said, like I said, I love the theatrical experience. I don't think it's going anywhere. I think it's sticking around. I think people are still going to movies, and I think they still will, at least for the foreseeable future. You know, as I can see the appeal of Netflix, I watch a lot of stuff on Netflix, but
Adam Sandler Murder Mysteries.
I loved it. I had so much fun. It was so much fun. I'm also in the tank for Sandler. I love that guy. I'll watch all his comedies and laugh my ass off. There's just something about him that hits my pleasure button. But, and oh my God, Uncut Gems.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
Amazing.
Yeah.
All right. So, but no, it's yeah, so I don't know if that answered the question or not.
Sure.
Yeah.
Last question. Is there anything coming down the pike in theaters that you are excited yourself to see or for other people to see?
Well, I saw a couple things at TIFF.
Yeah.
That are amazing. So Uncut Gems is up there at the top of the list. The Safdie brothers' new movie starring Sandler. And it's absolutely incredible. It is just like a lightning bolt. It's going into your brain. It's ridiculous. And it's also something you should see in the theater if you can. It's an experience. Marriage Story, I think, was incredible.
Yeah.
I think Noah Baumbach is just in this zone, because the Meyerowitz story is the last one that he did with Sandler.
Yeah.
I think that movie should have gotten so much more attention. I think that was...
Well, that's the Netflix argument. Like, does something disappear if it's a Netflix movie, you know?
But then also, getting back into talking about the Netflix thing, just part of me feels like, how do I define disability? Like, am I actually thinking, like, okay, you put something on Netflix, you don't get the marquee, you don't get, like, the newspaper articles with the ads or whatever, you don't get that element of it, but are exponentially more people actually watching it?
Yeah.
Is it my ego of just wanting that movie name on the marquee and wanting the...
Right.
And is the reality that, you know, if more people are actually watching your movie, is that something that matters, you know? So anyway, but Marriage Story, absolute masterpiece, I think. Absolutely incredible. And Scarlett is incredible. And Adam is phenomenal.
So
in
good.
It.
Laura Dern.
Yeah. And Ray Liotta. Oh, my
yeah.
God. Yeah, I just think it's absolutely amazing. And I hope that I hope it breaks out. I feel like he's in this really special place right now where he's just kind of at the top of his game. I hope people really discover it.
Yeah, yeah. Excellent. Well, yeah. Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you, Ryan.
Yeah, it was great talking.
I appreciate it.
That does it for this week's episode. We'll be back next week after our respective Thanksgiving holidays with lots more movies and awards and everything else to talk about. In the meantime, you can find us at VanityFair.com writing about a lot of these movies and on Twitter at LittleGoldMen and on our own. I'm at Katie Rich and Richard.
Rylaws.
And Joanna.
Joe wrote this.
This episode was edited and produced by Brett Fuchs, and happy Thanksgiving, everybody.
The Run Through with Vogue is where you'll meet all the most exciting people in fashion and culture.
I am Fran Lebowitz, who should be the mayor of New York.
We all support that. We support that.
Very nice.
Nikki.
Yes.
It's been really great being in this beautiful pink room.
All right, Usher, can you hear us?
I can hear you.
All right.
Can you hear me?
We can.
We can.
All right, here we are.
On the podcast, you'll learn how Vogue really works.
Sometimes we'll come in for a second or even third run through until we are AWOK.
Can you tell us what AWOK means?
It means AWOK, Anna Wintour OK.
I'm Cho Minardi.
And I'm Chloe Mel.
And we're the hosts of The Run Through with Vogue, where fashion and culture collide.
Join us. It's AWOK.
Listen and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.